Over these episodes, Inside the Bar has tried to highlight the true complexity of bringing criminal prosecutions to court. But there always seems to be a voice that isn't heard, that of the victims. Helen Bradley is a true pioneer in the field of victim advocacy. Listen in as she shares how she carried victim advocacy in Georgia from a closet in the DA's office in Savannah, Georgia, back in 1983, to supporting victims' rights legislation at Georgia's Capitol in the 2000s. Add writing a novel into the mix, and you know this episode can't be matched. Welcome back to Inside the Bar Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. I'm Christy Barker, a 25-plus year prosecutor, and I have with me, and I'm so thrilled about this, Helen Bradley, who is a longtime, well-decorated victim witness advocate. She is an amazing human being, has done incredible work across the community. She's an author. She's done a lot of work with writers and amazing things. I'm thrilled to have you on, Helen. Can you tell our audience a little bit about where you got started?
Well, I started many years ago after moving to Savannah from South Carolina. I was hired by District Attorney Spencer Lawton here in Chatham County.
How long ago was that?
That was in 1983.
Woo!
Which is crazy. I mean, crazy.
That's awesome.
So Elizabeth Stewart and Spencer Lawton started the very first victim witness assistance program in the state of Georgia.
Wow.
So we were very proud of that. And the bottom line is, as you know, in a prosecutor's office, the prosecutors are there to do all the legal work, to prosecute the criminals, to try to keep our community safer. And Spencer and Elizabeth realized there was a need for victim advocates to sort of be a go-between between the victims and the prosecutors. So somebody who could explain the legalese, help them through the criminal justice system. So we were not lawyers. We were advocates, just solely there on behalf of the victims and their families.
And, you know, that sounds so simple as a concept, but when you start talking about it, and of course, having been in the courtroom and knowing myself, I've upset a number of victims just because you get in this kind of machine mindset. Mm-hmm. And I know I'm not alone in that. And there's so many cases and there's so much work that needs to be done that a lot of times those victims, those witnesses get lost. And was that something you experienced? I mean, especially early on, it must have been kind of hard to get people to understand what you were doing.
Well, since we were the first program in the state, South Carolina and Florida actually were way far ahead of Georgia in the victim advocacy movement. But it's true. People at first were like, what are these victim advocates? What are they doing? But our job simply, and it wasn't simple, but our job was to help the victims and witnesses through the confusing maze of the criminal justice system. I mean, it is overwhelming and confusing. And most of the folks we worked with had never experienced that. And so we were there to provide support and practical information as well about what services were available.
And that had to be interesting to try to establish. So, you know, some of these services, and there are a lot more now,
right,
services, and I'm sure you are far more well-versed than I am, but a lot of those things didn't even exist then.
Exactly.
So how did you get the community to get involved in this?
Well, first of all, we had a very small paid staff. It was three of us for a while.
So it was Elizabeth, you, and who else?
Well, there were two of us for a while.
Oh, it was just the two of you.
It was just actually the two of us for a while. I correct myself.
You're adding people.
I know.
Wishful thinking.
Yeah. And we literally started in practically an office in the closet near the bathroom behind the grand jury room. And I reported to work on August 1st, 1983, and didn't know where I was going to report. And they showed us this little teeny space, and there we were. But you were asking about how to get the community involved. Victim Witness Assistance Program is truly a grassroots effort. So we used community volunteers. We had a wonderful group of volunteers, retired attorneys, social workers, college interns, just people in the community that wanted to help. And most of them came like either one morning a week or one afternoon a week, and they would help the victims, for example, meet them at the preliminary hearing and hand them a brochure, ask them if they have any questions, and let them know that victim witness is going to be there every step of the way to keep you informed about what's going on and try to answer any of your questions. So the community pretty quickly rallied around us.
Wow.
We didn't have
Right.
much funding at first, so we had to go to the county commission and beg for funds, and people had never heard of us, so that was a challenge. But Spencer Lawton stepped up to the plate and was able to get funding to start the program, and we eventually grew, of course. But it was quite an amazing effort at the beginning.
Well, and I can imagine because I started in the DA's office in 1994. So you guys have been going strong for 10 years. But you're starting in Savannah. Did it become kind of a flagship for other programs?
Yes, we were a
Let's talk
model.
about it.
We were a model for the state. I know I'm bragging, but
Yeah,
you're not close.
you are! Because I'm proud
Yeah,
of
thank you. We were a model for the state, and I told people we learned a lot and we made a lot of mistakes at the beginning so we could go help others not make those mistakes.
What kind of mistakes? I have to ask.
Here's a small but important example. One of the first victims we worked with was a woman whose husband was killed by his brother at a party. She truly, Kathy Newman, helped us establish this program because we would go to her and say, "What do you need?" And she would say, "I need this." But here's an example. We did a brochure and we had a picture of the crime scene of where her husband's crime happened, and that upset her.
Right.
So we should have gotten permission to do that. So we just learned a lot along the way, and we ended up going across the nation doing training. We got help from the National Organization for Victim Assistance out of Washington, D.C. They literally flew down to Savannah and helped do a training for our prosecutors and
Wow.
staff because they were so pleased that was finally something happening in Georgia. They said, "We'll come down." And they brought a team of like five people, and
Wow.
we met and learned a lot. We had a lot to learn. And our neighboring states of Florida and South Carolina taught us a lot. So it was a learning curve, but we learned as we went along and we listened to victims,
That is not as simple as you're making it sound.
It's not.
And there's listening and there's active listening, I guess. Tell me about what it is like to sit down with somebody who's just been through a traumatic experience like that.
Well, first of all, we did not go on the scene of crime. Some people misunderstand that, but we did not do that. But I'll give the example of the woman, one of our first victims, of course, who I'll always remember. And she said, "Helen, I've told you the story about what happened to my husband 20 times. And I've told you 20 times because my family and friends, are tired of listening. I don't want to repeat it to them. And it helps me realize and come to realization what happened." So we just had to be and wanted to be active listeners and people who could be there and hear what their needs were, hear their questions. We certainly ended up learning about legislation that needed to be changed. So, and then we offered very practical assistance as well. As you know, we sent letters letting people know the status of the case because, as you also know, the victims and witnesses are not required at every hearing, thank goodness.
No, yeah.
Grand jury hearing mostly are not required to be there. So we would send them letters and make phone calls to say, "Here's what happened," because otherwise they think, "Well, that DA's office has forgotten about me. Nothing's happening." When in fact, you prosecutors were working hard on the cases, but the victims just didn't know that. So we would offer practical assistance. We would, Here's another example. An elderly woman whose home was burglarized while she was away, and she had never been to court, in her life, never been to the
Sure.
courthouse. She said, "I've
Oh.
never even had a parking ticket." So we had someone meet her in the lobby to escort her to the preliminary hearing to make sure she understood what to expect, what to do, what not to do, to And just we would tell people, your job is to tell the truth.
Yeah.
You know, that's the main thing. So we let them know about our other services, such as the Rape Crisis Center and a Safe Shelter, and the Children's Advocacy Center were three organizations. The Advocacy Center had not started yet, but the other two agencies had.
So Safe Shelter and Red Crosses were already in place.
They were.
Oh, wow.
Not for long, but they were already in place. Yes.
I was going to say, because I know that you're very close with folks from both of those organizations, and it kind of makes sense that everybody was kind of coming up and learning together.
Mm-hmm.
And they are, but they offer such different things.
Right,
And so, and maybe that's worth talking about too. And you had mentioned before we started recording that this is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and both Safe Shelter particularly, but Safe Shelter and Rape Crisis often deal with a lot of the dynamics you see in domestic violence.
Yes.
So how would those services be different from what the victim witness assistance does?
Well, those wonderful services, of course, Safe Shelter provided literally safe shelter for families. I had the honor the other day of meeting one of the founders of Safe Shelter, which she said, Helen, it started around our kitchen table. Because there was a woman in need. And she said at that time there was a place for women to go, but not a place for the children to come with them.
Wow.
So it was quite a grassroots effort. And their services are counseling. They do a lot of counseling. They do prevention services. Safe Shelter also provides advocacy for those going into the court system that want to get a temporary protective order, for example.
Right.
So people think, oh, shelter is just for going and staying at a shelter, but it's also for folks who want to, you know, learn how to get some legal ramifications civilly.
Right. Right. And those things then become something that can be important in a criminal prosecution as well.
Absolutely.
But that protection that's there, like that violation of a temporary protective order, is something that could be potentially criminal in certain circumstances.
Exactly.
So having those safety nets or those safeguards in place is really important.
Absolutely.
I'm impressed that it was going back that far. I think I just kind of thought y'all were first and everything else kind of expanded from there.
Yeah, those nonprofits started shortly before Victim Witness Assistance.
Wow.
But there had been nobody solely working in the criminal justice system. So that's where we came in, is to help with the
walking people through.
Yes, that confusing criminal. I had to learn a lot myself. You know,
it changes all the time. We have to relearn all the
It
time.
Was confusing. And we would always explain to them, we're not lawyers, but we can help explain to you what happens in the grand jury setting. You know, what is that all about? We have something in Chatham County, or used to, called a calendar call, you know, which is just sort of a scheduling thing. And I'll never forget, a victim said, what is a cattle call? And we're like, oh, well,
or the arrangement.
Or the arrangement for arraignment.
Yes.
So it's one way. And then, of course, there was legislation that needed to be passed, we realized.
What kind of legislation? Because I know you got involved, and there have been multiple forms of it since you started working in this area. So talk to me about some of the early legislation that y'all had to do.
One of the most important ones was the Victim Compensation Program. And that was back in the 90s. I don't have the exact date. But the Victim Compensation Program is actually funded by criminal fines. So it's not our tax dollars, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
And that is to help victims of violent crimes with unreimbursed expenses caused by the crime, such as medical expenses not covered by insurance, such as counseling expenses, sadly, funeral expenses for homicide victims' families, in some cases, lost wages because they had to miss so much work because they were out in the hospital or sick or unable to work. So that was just so exciting. We had to get actually that amendment passed in the state of Georgia. Yeah, not just legislation, but an amendment.
So how much work was this? Did you have to like go and testify before the legislature?
Yes, we did.
Wow.
Yeah, we went, and of course then got people from all over the state involved. And, you know, just educating legislators, because they didn't know that this was so needed. I mean, nobody had talked to them about it before. And I will say our Savannah legislators were extremely supportive, But we first got victim compensation passed, and we called it the Victim Emergency Fund, and it was only $1,000 maximum, so it was
Oh my gosh.
really, really small. But we got our foot in the door, and then within a couple of years, we were able to increase the cap that people could get in victim compensation. So, but passing an amendment, is not an easy thing to do. That's not as common as passing a legislative bill. So
Sure, yeah.
that was exciting. And then in 2004, the Crime Victims Bill of Rights was passed, which, as gives victims the right mainly to be informed every step of the way and to have input about what's going on. Doesn't mean they can decide, the prosecutor decides that what the charges are going to be and how it's going to be handled, but making sure that the victims have their say and are able to speak out as well as to be informed every step of the way. And keep in mind, some victim witness programs were just starting up, so this really helped them to those communities to realize we need somebody to do this. We need advocates.
Well, the thing that's true, though, and there were two aspects of the things we're just talking about. One of which, you see the after effects, like you're talking about fines funding the Victim Compensation Fund, and yet everybody these days is like, oh, we need to waive fines. They're punitive, blah,
Right.
blah, blah. It's like, no, this is actually like, it's almost like restitution.
Right.
And so, it makes so much sense that it's set up that way, but because of changes in community mindset, they aren't really seeing the ramifications of
Right.
something like, oh, I'm going to waive the fine.
Exactly.
But the other thing that you're talking about with the Victims' Bill of Rights, and it still seems to be something that we fight in court
I know.
all the time. And it's so bad that even with this whole statutory scheme they've already described, at least in part, they had to pass a Georgia constitutional amendment, Marcy's Law,
Right.
and still we have this fight. I mean, and they're very specific. I mean, when you read these legal documents or the statutory scheme and the case law and all of that stuff, if it ever gets far enough, the appellate courts agree, like, this
Right.
language is really clear. You need to
Right.
be letting victims in the courtroom, like,
Exactly.
throughout the process. You need to let the victim's family in a homicide case stay in the courtroom unless they're disruptive.
Exactly.
And yet there are jurisdictions in this state, and I am seeing it even now, where that's a fight every single case. Every single
Well,
case.
that's a shame because, I think it's one in three families will be affected by crime somehow. And I guess not until somebody's been a crime victim do they understand the need for this. So that legislation is so important. And I do feel like you're right. I mean, I've been out of the field for quite a while now, but victims can't give up their fight. We've got to keep plugging along, advocates and prosecutors, making sure that victims are included in the system.
Well, and it's so cathartic. And I've seen this, like, I've been handling some cases where children are victims of late, for a child to have the choice. And if they want to be present and see what happens with a case where they've been involved, it can be really hard,
Right.
but it can also be really important for them to understand this process and
And
what's
that
being
someone is
said.
taking them seriously.
Right. And it's also important sometimes for the person that's accused in a case, they don't get to say the same things if the victim's in the room. I
Right.
mean, it's much like the whole Sixth Amendment thing where you confront and cross-examine the witnesses against you. The same thing can be true for a victim. Like, it's much harder for a defendant to get up and lie
Right.
to the victim's face.
Right.
And some people have zero conscience, but
Right.
and
Right.
we've seen that too. But it is a really important element that just still seems to get lost, and
And
I don't really
that's a
understand
crying
it.
shame.
It is.
Well, and one thing I would just want to add to about crime victim compensation, think about those crimes that happen when no one is arrested. So there's a
Oh,
violent
Lord.
crime. So compensation, as long as the victim reported the crime and cooperates with law enforcement, they are still able to apply for compensation to help with expenses caused by the crime, even if there's not an arrest. So that's helpful.
Yeah, that's huge. I don't
Yeah.
think I knew that. So,
Yeah,
yeah.
that's important because they really feel frustrated. You know, the criminal's
Right.
still out on the street and they don't feel safe.
And
So
there's no justice. I mean, there's no sense of justice.
exactly.
And the least we can do is make them a tiny bit whole.
Exactly. Exactly.
And I don't know how you would talk. When I would sit down, particularly with homicide victim families, it was always very clear to me that the system can't fill the hole.
Oh, that's true.
How is that as a conversation that you have with people?
I saw many times, as did you, in the many homicide cases you did, the trial's over with. Maybe there was conviction, but that person's son or that person's brother or mother is not coming back. And there's often sort of, they're glad there's closure in the criminal justice system. And we would tell them, it's still going to be tough. We cannot predict what's going to happen. I used to say, you don't know what a jury of 12 people is going to do. My friends, three of us can't decide where to go to lunch, you know.
Yeah, true.
So then being able to decide on a very serious matter and get all 12 people to agree. So we gave them realistic information. We did not try to sugarcoat it. It's
Good.
like, this is what is, we don't know what's going to happen, but you're going to be a part of the process and we're going to keep you informed. But you know, it does not bring their loved one back, for example, or as it doesn't take away the trauma from a rape victim or a child abuse victim, but it does help them know that they were listened to, they were believed, and you prosecutors did everything you can to make sure that the criminal is not going to be hurting other people.
Right,
So
right.
it's a tough conversation.
Well, right. But there are so many ways in which the system seems to potentially and often feels like it fails victims. And I think that we see that it's almost more frustrating. Like if for whatever reason the system fails, you see how torn that person is, that victim is, or that family is. And that goes back out into the street.
Yeah.
And how are they going to behave going forward?
Right.
Are they going to come to the police? Are they going to take matters in
Exactly.
their own hands? I
Well, we call it, they feel victimized again by a
Right.
system.
Right.
Victimized again.
Right.
And that is just, you know, adding injury to their pain already.
Yeah.
So.
And I'm sure you've seen that. I mean, and we talk about victim assistance, like all of the victims are like, yay, let's go to court. Is that true?
No. Some of them are very hesitant. Partly because it's overwhelming and confusing, and partly, as you know, there's witness intimidation, and people are scared. Particularly young people, I think, are frightened when they're gang members and there are other people that are saying, "Don't go to court, or this will happen."
Right.
I used to have to tell people, "We're not the witness protection program. You know, we don't hide people and put up in the hotels."
Right.
But and it's a real concern for people. That who's going to be snitching on you, and that's a difficult.
Yeah.
But you know, we can't promise anything. It's the bottom line.
Right. There's the system is not big enough.
Exactly.
You've done a huge amount of work, though, making it bigger than more a bigger support network.
Right.
How long were you that? I mean, I know Elizabeth started, but she retired when?
She was there for 2 years, got the
Okay.
program started. So, and then I was hired as the director in 85. I was there 27 years.
Yeah, I mean, when I think of victim witness, I think of Helen. So, yeah.
Was there a lot, and I saw a lot of improvement and changes. So that was exciting to see the growth.
What was
And
the
just
best thing? What would you say is the best thing
about,
about the improvements? What are you saying? You've
oh,
accomplished so much. What would you
well, it
say is
wasn't
it?
me, it was a lot of people, but we did gather together a lot of advocates. It was seeing people across the state, prosecutors, judges, all sorts of people who came finally to understand that this is an important part of the justice system. Because I'll admit, it was tough at first. They were like, who are these people in our courtroom? And what are they doing? Are they going to try to tell us what to do? So it was a change in mindset. It was so exciting. And then people got on board and realized this can help make the system better. This victim advocates are not there to take away any rights of criminals. And think about it, Christy, it's called the criminal justice system. And we just wanted to make sure that victims are not forgotten and that their rights are respected. So it's not to take away anything. I'm sure defense attorneys at first were like really concerned.
I think they still are.
Well, yeah,
Yeah.
probably. So I guess the best thing was just, and then of course, just seeing victims. And I was inspired by so many victims. Their strength and their resilience was just amazing to me. And we would say to them, we're here for you, but we would also ask, who is your support system? Is it the church? Is it your neighborhood? Reach out to them too, because that's why we would have those seminars for clergy
Right.
in which we would help explain the services available. Because many times, if you're in a crisis, you're not going to go to a courthouse or a justice system.
They are not your friend, or that's the mindset.
Right, that you're going to go to your neighbor or to your clergy person or somebody at work. So we did our best to try to educate folks, the school system, school teachers, counselors, clergy persons, and lay leaders about here are the services available. We gave them brochures that listed all the phone numbers of all the places they could get help. So that was exciting too, to start working with the clergy. That was really eye-opening.
One, and again, everyone's got a different viewpoint, right? And
Right.
so they get to see, and people will tell one person something that they might feel uncomfortable telling
Right.
somebody else.
Exactly.
And I think, that's something too that has evolved over time, is there is now a privilege for what is told to victim witness advocates,
Right.
which didn't exist before.
Exactly.
And it's a huge change in mindset that, you need to be proud of what you've done.
I'm very proud.
You
I
should
am.
be. You should be. But you talked about there are some of the people whose stories were really inspirational to you. Can you tell me about any of them?
Let's see. There were so many. I can think of a woman who was a sexual assault victim, a very serious sexual assault victim. And she went through a lot of trauma, of course. She had to go through the court system. She went to counseling, thank goodness, got therapy, which helped her deal with her trauma and her post-traumatic stress disorder, which she had as well. And then her healing began, and she then became a wonderful victim advocate in another part of the state. So that was just, I
Oh, that's
included that in my
wonderful.
book, I think. But that was so exciting to see her then helping others. And that's often the case. Victims will say, what can I do? And we have victims who would go to the legislature, to the Capitol, and they've never done that before,
Yeah.
and they would say, I need to speak to you about why we need this law.
Yeah.
And that was empowering to them as well,
Right.
because really, as crime is about power over someone else. And anything we could do to help them regain their sense of worth and their power,
Yeah.
it was really important, because they didn't want to be a victim. They didn't want to be called a victim. They're really survivors.
Yeah.
So just learning from so many victims, and seeing their resilience many times over,
Yeah.
it was great for me to see.
That it is an inspiration though, because it makes you, I always felt like we were meeting people at their worst.
Exactly.
You're in this horrible situation, and I get to meet you, and you might be amazing all the time,
But here you are in
but
this horrible
right.
situation. Well, of a lady who's been quite an advocate and doing crime prevention. So that's an
I
inspiration.
do. You're talking about Linda Wilder Bryan?
Linda Wilder Bryant is an example who went through horrific crime and
Yeah.
that you
Well, and when you
prosecuted a
talk about
case.
well, right, but you're talking about somebody who went to the legislature,
Exactly.
and went and fought for, and she's on the city council fighting for the community, and you know that sense of this is one of the aspects of where you live,
Exactly. It's our community.
right?
And every time a crime happens in our community, it touches all of us, really.
It does.
It makes us more fearful. It makes us wonder what's going to happen when we walk outside or what's going to happen to my teenage son. It's
Yeah,
scary.
it is scary. And you know, we all have to, we want to have faith in the other people that are part of that community, that if we are working against each other, we're not going to get there.
Exactly.
And you know, that it should be a unifying thing. Like, none of us thinks murder's okay.
Exactly.
So can we agree on that? You know, can I get
Exactly.
an amen for that one?
Exactly.
And I think that it seems to be getting lost. And maybe that's just my sense of where the world is right now. I just feel like we have lost those unifying concepts that seemed very simple, and they should still be. I think they
I
still
know,
are.
I know. It's, well, again, I've been out of the field for a while, but it's just, you want people to pull together as a community. And it doesn't have to be some huge something. You know, it can be starting a neighborhood watch program. It can be talking to your police officer on the beat and small things, writing a letter to the editor. There's so many ways that people can come together and support each other and
Right.
to not blame victims. We tend to do that. And I'm not saying all victims are, you know, choir boys or
They
whatever,
aren't.
but
Things don't happen in front of busloads of nuns.
exactly. I
Yeah.
like that. I like that.
Stole that from June Fogle.
I like that one.
Yeah.
But I have a theory as to why people tend to blame victims. And that theory is this: it is because I like to think I live in a safe world and I don't do anything stupid. You know, I don't do drugs. I'm not, you know, out on River Street at 3 o'clock in the morning prancing around, although I have a right to do that.
Yes.
So I live in this world that I think is safe. I think that I'm going to leave here tonight, drive home, and it will never occur to me that a drunk driver may hit me. That's not my world. I'm just going to go home and eat my dinner, and that's it. So we like to protect ourselves by saying, well, that victim must have done something wrong.
Yeah.
What were they doing? And again, they may have been doing something wrong, but they don't deserve to be murdered, for example,
Right.
and they don't deserve to be sexually assaulted.
Right.
People make poor choices. That is absolutely true. So I think that's why I think that's why we tend to blame victims, because it helps protect our sense of the world.
Right. Well, I'm sure you have sat there 8,000 more closing arguments than I have, but the defense argument of when you point the finger at somebody, their four fingers pointing back at you,
Yeah.
it's like, no, this isn't about being blameless.
Right, exactly.
It's not. It's about someone being held accountable for actions that they took that are violations of the law. That's
Exactly,
it.
exactly,
And you know what? They need to be held accountable for it.
exactly.
But you know, there's so many parts of the structure that have got to work to make that work and to have people have faith in the system, one of which, of course, is being there for victims and
Yes.
notifying them and talking to them and making sure that they understand what's going on. Another part, of course, is, you know, if you get all the way through a trial, let's get a decent sentence, you
Yeah,
know.
exactly.
Or the parole system. Did you have to deal with parole at all?
Yes. And one of the pieces of legislation that passed was that the parole board has to notify victims or
That
victims'
was late in
families.
the
It
game.
was late in the game to notify victims or their families of when this person was up for parole. Because let's think about it. And it could be something nonviolent. Elderly woman that we worked with whose home was burglarized. Do you think she wanted to go in the grocery store 2 years later and run into the people who burglarized her home?
No.
She needed to know that they were getting out. She may not like it, but she needed to be informed. So that was an example of some legislation that we worked on and worked with the parole board. And we even, well, unlike most states, we usually don't have the victims present at parole hearings. Other states do. But they need to be able to have their input by victim impact statements. and by sending letters, you know, to let them know here's what happened and I want you to hear my side of the story. So yeah, we worked hard with the parole board.
Well, and that, and it made me think of, pardons. There was a case, and Greg McConnell, that we worked with for ages and ages, worked on child victim cases. And Greg had a case where someone was granted a pardon, on a case involving a child
Goodness
victim,
gracious.
and no one was notified.
It's
And
horrible.
this poor child victim, who's no longer a child, I think, by that time, sees this person walking around and notifies. And actually, it may have been that he reached out to the victim and notifies people, hey, I'm getting contact. This shouldn't be happening. He got a pardon.
That's amazing.
It's
That's
horrifying.
a failure of the system
It
right
is a
there.
failure of the system, but the system, and this is why, one of the thousands of reasons, people feel like the system doesn't work. I mean, it starts on the street with officers. I've had that discussion, I don't know how many times with people on this show, because I feel like we need to let people know that it's not something we're advocating for. What we want and what you want and what all of us want is for people to feel some sense of safety. And everyone's entitled to that, I think. I think that's fair.
Absolutely.
I don't. I don't know where we're going with some of this stuff. There were a couple of things that I wanted to kind of touch on too before we get to talking about your book, which I know is like a reason why you're like here and like, I want to talk about my
Oh
book.
gosh.
So you retired. When did you retire?
In 2010.
And it's entirely up to you whether you want to talk about that, the circumstances. But when you retired, you started doing some other work in the community. What were you doing?
Oh, I started volunteering with the DEEP program, which is a program that at that time primarily worked with middle school students in writing. And so, as a volunteer, I would go once a week with another volunteer to a middle school after school for a
Middle
couple of
school's a
hours.
tough
Oh, I know,
age.
I was scared to death at first, but they were awesome. And we would just mentor them in their writing. So we didn't teach them grammar and punctuation, but we helped them to express themselves. And these were in some of the schools with lower income kids. So this was an exciting opportunity for them. So I loved that mentoring young writers, and their works that they wrote ended up getting published in the books. That was
Wow.
just so cool. So
That is
that was
cool.
fun.
Was that really empowering for them? I mean,
It was empowering for them. I saw children that maybe, and they didn't make great grades, maybe they weren't in athletics. And this was a way that they could express themselves. And let me tell you, Christy, many of those students express themselves about violence in their communities.
did they really?
Absolutely.
What kinds of things would they talk
They
about?
would talk about their next door neighbor being murdered.
Good Lord.
They would write about crime sometimes. And I'm not saying that's all they wrote about, but it was certainly an outlet for them to discuss their fear,
Right.
you know, of, am I
That
going to
is
make it
sad.
through middle school and high school without getting hurt? Now, is that sad?
That
Just
is horribly sad.
broke my heart.
That is awful.
So I did that, and then I did a wild thing and became a wedding officiant. So
Yeah, you are like having weddings all the time. What
it's,
inspired that?
I will tell you, I was back at the courthouse, and one of the judges suggested that I become a wedding officiant, and also Marianne Boyd, who works in the courthouse.
There you go.
So
Oh,
she,
Marianne was my admin
I
forever. I
know she's the
love
best
her. She's the best.
because yeah, she's great. Because a
Yes.
lot of the judges just didn't have time to do these quick weddings. So couples thought they could go to the courthouse, get their marriage license from private court, and then go down the hall and get married. Well, it doesn't happen like that. So
No.
anyway, I became a wedding officiant, which was the last thing I expected that I would be doing. But it's a fun little gig.
Do you love
Love it. It's just fun.
it?
I meet interesting people.
That's
I know
fascinating.
it's totally different from victim advocacy, so.
It's awesome that you actually followed through on that. People will suggest stuff and you'll be like,
I know.
that.
I thought it was just crazy idea, but then I was like, this sounds fun. And then again, the kids at the DEEP program, the writing program, they're the ones that inspired me to do more writing.
Let's
I
talk
did.
about writing. Let's talk about the work you have done writing. And of course, we want to talk about your book. So tell me how you got inspired and where that went.
One summer, the DEET program offered to volunteer, since we weren't going to be in school, they offered to do writing groups for the summer. You could choose between poetry, fiction, and nonfiction. I chose nonfiction because I had been a journalist right out of college at a newspaper.
How long were you a journalist?
Just a couple of years, but I learned a lot. And so one of the last things I wrote was about a real incident that had happened in my career, which is where a young person committed, I mean, accused someone of sexual assault. I mean, of sexual harassment, excuse me. Anyway, I ended up fictionalizing a story. I ended up working for almost 10 years writing a book. And my novel came out in April, and it's called Breach of Trust. And it's about a victim advocate.
Wait, is this someone I
No, Ann Gardner is the protagonist. And
She
it is,
sounds a little familiar.
well, she might be, for some of the courthouse people might sound a little familiar
A
too,
little
Chrissy.
familiar for sure.
But it really is fictionalized. But I will be honest, it's inspired by some true events. And there's political corruption, domestic violence, sexual harassment, and a little humor thrown in there, believe it or not. You've
There
read it,
is.
you know.
I love your book. It's part of the reason I wanted to talk about it. So I love so much about this book. Obviously, I love the truthfulness because again, there are incidents and accidents and whatever else that I recognize, and voices that sound
Right.
familiar. But at the same time, there's this lovely background of Savannah, and you really bring that to life too. So, how hard was this 10-year venture?
It was hard at first because I had
All
no idea what I
right.
was doing. I had been a journalist and written little short stories, and now I was supposed to write a book. I'm gonna write a book. So I'm in a writing critique group that meets every week. There are four of us. They were completely inspirational. They were wonderful. So every week I would bring in a chapter or a few pages that I had written. And they would, give me suggestions and ideas and ask questions, and we did that for each other. And the hardest part was putting it all together. So it was,
Transitions.
yeah, transitions and figuring out what comes first and second. And there's a backstory about the character in college. And so it was quite a journey, and I have learned so much, but it's been fun. Like I said, it's been out since April, and the Savannah community has been extremely supportive of my book, Breach of Trust.
Breach of trust. And I love some of the themes in this too, because I feel like while the incidents that inspired this were a long time ago, there's still an element of there's this kind of stuff still going on.
Right. Well, it's true. And of course, you look in the media every day and you hear about, obviously these would be national people, famous people, athletes or movie stars or whatever.
Big
So,
politicians.
yeah, politicians. But sexual harassment is still a very timely topic. And when I talk to people who've read this book, particularly women, middle-aged and older, they talk about the hell they went through. Maybe in the 70s and the 60s, when they were not believed, it was not reported. If it was reported, perhaps nothing happened.
Shrugged off.
Shrugged off. You're exactly right. So it's been interesting to hear that perspective, as well as some young people now who say they're going through some of the same issues. So I almost feel like a victim advocate again because I'm able to talk to and listen to some of these people and understand some of their trials and tribulations they're going through. But the book is set in Savannah and Tybee. And so Savannah people love recognizing some of the
That's true.
places.
That's
So
true. But again, there's some darkness in here, and I'm always I'm that person. That's probably why I do what I do. But just the fact that you don't hide the grime,
right.
and you don't glorify it either.
Right. There's some painful parts in that book, definitely. There's some dark
Was it hard to write? I mean, just some of it.
Some of it was. It was two things. It was cathartic in a way, and then it was painful. So there were some, and I don't know. I guess it depended on the day or what I was writing. So it was, I cried when I wrote some chapters, and I smiled when I wrote some, thinking about some of the victims that I had met and that it inspired me. So it was a mixed bag, but I'm finally glad it's out in the world.
Yeah, no, and again, it is an amazing accomplishment, and I really love the book. But when I read it, particularly because I'm familiar with some of these inspirational events, I almost felt like I had a little bit of PTSD. I was
Yeah,
back, and I
I
didn't
know.
realize, and I'm sure that's true for people who are recognizing things in the other parts of this. You compartmentalize it, you put it away.
Exactly.
And then you bring it back out. It's like, ooh, that was
Nasty. I know.
not pleasant. I don't remember. I didn't know that I was going to remember it that
I
way.
know.
And it was really interesting.
Yeah, it's
Really
been,
interesting.
yeah, it can bring tough memories to people, but the main character is someone who's goes on quite a journey, and she grows and becomes empowered. So that's important,
Yeah.
I think, to show that. And this month, October, is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. So proceeds from all sales this month go to Safe Shelter for domestic violence services. So.
Like you didn't have a good reason to buy this book to begin with, but yeah, I know. I mean, as we talked about, that is such a great community, and they need all the help they can get.
Yeah, so yeah, they really they had their gala, I think, last week in a fundraising event. I donated a couple of books, but I was told by people who were there that, they're the shelter is, well, as of last week, was full, and they were putting people in hotels. So they need some more resources. So anybody, I'm putting in a plug for Safe Shelter. Anyone who's willing to support Safe Shelter by giving directly or by buying my book. And my book recently got into Barnes and Noble and over Barnes and Noble. And it's, of course, online at Amazon and Barnes and Noble and all sorts of local places too.
Fantastic. Well, I am, again, I can't say enough good things about you and this book and just
Well,
knowing
thank
you.
you. I appreciate your having me and talking with me. This has been interesting.
Has been super fun, and I'm going to get this out as soon as possible because we
Okay.
need to capitalize on Domestic Violence Awareness
Awareness.
Month.
Yes,
But
absolutely.
thank you so much, Helen.
Thank you, Christy. It's a
And,
pleasure. Always a pleasure.
well, it's always a pleasure for me too. As you can tell, Helen's genuine ability to empathize and build rapport with people of all backgrounds informs all of her endeavors. From courtrooms to the Capitol to middle schools and the author's desk, Helen Bradley is truly a gem with many facets. While I'm grateful to have had the opportunity to work with such a rock star advocate, her book, Reach of Trust, is a must read for survivors of all kinds and gives you a window into the world of victim advocacy. I hope to be back soon with more deep dives into the world of criminal prosecution and what it takes to bring a case to court. Stay tuned.